I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. It comes down to this. Were you or are you a fool for majoring in the humanities in school? Art, history, philosophy, literature, languages? Gina Bereke and I are asking because we understand practical decisions in a time of high unemployment. High value is now placed on math, chemistry, science, technology, business school, supply chain. What's useful now is the way that the thinking goes. So this is no idle debate. Some colleges and universities are quietly gutting departments of literature, art, philosophy, history, and music. It's all about job training now. But what makes an educated person? And is it in a company's interest to employ a fully educated person? We're talking about this because of the response to Gina Bereke's column in the Hartford Courant on this provocative subject. We have that column at our website, WNPR.org. I encourage you to look at it now or later. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Gina is a literature professor at UConn Storrs, the author of 8 books, and a feminist scholar. And one of those books is the reissue of the new edition of They Used to Call Me Snow White, But I Drifted, one of the great titles ever. So here we are, Gina. So many people are out of work. A lot of young people decided to go back to school to avoid the job crunch. Everybody is nervous about getting a job. So what about the practicality of taking courses that put you in the pipeline for jobs in medicine, science, technology, engineering, and hospitality?
All of those are excellent choices, and it's not something I would disagree with at all. As somebody who was the first in my family, maybe as is the case of many of the listeners, the first in my family to go to college, first girl in my family to go to college, first girl in my family to graduate from high school in a timely fashion. in my family, they were called working papers for a reason. You went to work. That an education was something that the family felt they couldn't afford. You had to go to work as soon as you could. So that education at all was a luxury that seemed to be out of reach. And I'm 56. I mean, we're not talking about, 4,000 years ago or something. I mean, we're talking about, a couple of generations ago.
So you're saying practicality, we get it.
Right. Fine. So that I understand the context that people are coming out of. But it's also important for people who are going into medicine, into engineering, who are going into technology, who intend to be in hospitality, who intend to be in the most practically applicable subjects, to have an actual education, not just training in a particular set of skills.
Why?
Because
what would the humanities do for that person?
Because it gives you an understanding of context. It gives you perspective. It lets you into, as one of the great responses from a reader to the column wrote to me, a guy I've never met named Timothy, whose name I'm not remembering now because I don't know him, said that what the humanities do is let you join the adult conversation. The adults have been having conversations in the room for thousands of years. And when you learn about philosophy, religion, history, literature, when you understand that this conversation between cultures and within your own culture has been going on, you then, not only does it actually ground you so that you don't think that you're the first one ever to have a good idea, which, is the mark of someone who is, if not stupid, at least very ignorant. You can be skilled and ignorant. What having a grounding in the humanities does is to make sure that you understand that imagination is important, that critical thinking is important, that it allows the people who are going into the most technical, detailed fields or the most practically applicable fields to have a wider vision of what they're doing.
How about these works of literature, fiction, in their way through that story, through these characters, tell us how to live?
That's a lovely way. That's a poetic way of looking at it. I think we can even look at it more practically than that. You read the study, I know, Faith. We talked about it, where I think it was a psychology study, maybe it was sociology that came out that talked about people being more empathetic when
they were reading.
Right. So that, you know, does reading Chekhov actually make you a better person? And it turns out that people were sensitized in ways that they hadn't been once they had read a story, as opposed to beginning just, a ledger with numbers in it.
So here's what we're seeing out there right now. We've got colleges and universities gutting these departments that are in the humanities, so English, literature, languages, philosophy, art, music, education, all of that being slimmed down, scaled back, and building up the other side, which would be all the sciences, the math departments, especially science, because that's right. where the money's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
We've got people in universities and colleges talking about marketing, in
right.
quotes.
Mm-hmm.
So let's market this university as a job pipeline right. to the nearest corporations. Understandably so, because everybody's in a panic right now about jobs, kids, the whole thing, loans to pay off. But I have this question for you, and it comes out of something you said to me. So I'm really stealing this question
Good.
From you. Would we see private schools doing what state schools are doing right now?
Never. That's absolutely what scares me the most. And actually, I would say that schools of education are not having their money taken away from them. Schools of education don't come under the same aegis as the humanities, because those are, again, schools of education are training people for practical, skill-based futures, so that they're like schools of pharmacy, schools of engineering. They have differing sort of funding sort of areas. So that's the one exception I'd make to that. But back to the important question. I believe, and if you permit me, I'm going to read this, because this was one of the paragraphs from the article that was just in the Hartford Current, and that the columns from the Current are distributed through the McClatchy Tribune Syndicate. So they get published around the country. And this got over 1,000 shares just from the Current. And then that doesn't count the ones that appeared in Arizona and Florida, in Iowa and Virginia. And a lot of people commented on this particular paragraph. So this one says, public universities are in particular danger of contorting and at their worst moments crippling their student bodies if they define themselves as simply a way for students to get better jobs. In such a caged context, colleges are in danger of becoming service institutions. In public institutions, if we will train the workers of the world, sure, but then we're not going to give them anything in the humanities to unite them, to inspire them, to sensitize them, or to unite them. So that, I think I misread something in that, but it's the idea that somehow I was a scholarship student at Dartmouth College. I go back to Dartmouth often. They invite me back to talk to their students, to talk to their administration. And Dartmouth, Yale, any of the Ivy League schools, the privileged Stanford, the University of Chicago, the privileged universities are never going to take away their humanities and arts classes, because they understand they have a long history of training gentlemen. Recently, they have a more recent history of training women, but that they know that when the people who are actually get together, who are running things, whether that's running the government, whether it's running corporations, whether it's making policy, designing instruments, whatever it is, for the people who are running Boeing or the people who are curating for the Smithsonian or the Metropolitan Museum of Art, people, when they get together, are not talking about their jobs. They're talking about culture. Movies and books. I mean, that engineers
museums
are talking about, what novels they just read. They're not talking about engineering, not the people who are actually designing and implementing and understanding and creating the future.
Well, come back to the private school idea for a minute. You said private schools and private universities would never, especially the elite ones,
right.
would never take away the humanities departments.
Right.
Don't have this similar sense of we're training you for the job pipeline. Is that true because the humanities are so well endowed by wealthy donors, whereas state schools have to make cuts and they think, quote unquote, practically, where are we going to make the cuts? Well, look at this atmosphere we're in. We better be training these kids so that we can say to these parents, come here. We're fighting to get these kids to come to our school. Come here because we know how to get your kid a job.
But that can't be the purpose of a real education. The purpose of a real education is not to make sure that somebody makes $155,000 as soon as they leave. I mean, if all we want, somebody said to me that the days of furthering and bettering yourself through a liberal arts education are over. And I said, you know, that's true only if furthering, bettering, and bettering actually translates into making more money. Okay? I mean, if furthering and bettering, I'd like to think, has a wider sort of definition. And if all we want to do is train our kids to make money, then let's teach them how to write ransom notes. Right? Then, you know, just teach them. I mean, that can't be what it is. That is not the object of any school, university education. And if we're going to teach them to write ransom notes, we can teach them to do it grammatically.
Well, then why are state schools and universities doing this, do you think?
I think that there is a very much, I mean, trust me, I'm committed to teach at a state university. Having come out of a private school, I know that I can make happen in a state university classroom what happens in any private school, however well endowed, because what goes on, the magic, the astonishing thing that happens in a classroom can happen in any classroom, as long as you've got the support from the institution to allow it to happen. So let me just give you a practical example. This semester, I'm teaching a course on medicine and literature. Now, that to me is I've never taught this course before. I've been at UConn for 26 years, right? And I had so many students in a number of my classes the last few years who were pre-med students. And they have very few options to take humanities classes or English classes. But I had a number of them who were interested. And so they were coming, and there were, I think, four this year who said, can we do independent studies? I often do independent studies where I work. I also went to Cambridge University when I finished from Dartmouth. I like the tutorial system where you work one-on-one with a student. I do that a lot with a number of students. It's not something, you know, I don't get a commission on this. It's just what I do. It's my job. It's my vocation. But four of them wanted to do something on medicine in literature. And I said, I'm just going to do a class. So I now have a class that's sort of half English majors, half pre-med or biology, neuropsychology students. They come out of very different backgrounds. We have astonishing discussions, whether it's about Bulakov's A Young Doctor's Notebook or Hilary Mantel's memoir of her endometriosis and her madness and seeing the devil and bringing up the ghost, or Alias Grace by Margaret Atwood. We're going to end with The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, John Hopkins University. So, there are ways of bringing all of this together so that you see the practical application of a literary context and the idea of seeing how stories affect how we think about our lives, including the professional lives.
I'm interested in what businesses say about this. I'm interested in what parents want to say and what students are thinking right now as they're about to sign up for school or are in school right now or are out of work after school. This is a conversation I would love to have. We're going to open the phones to you at 203-776-9677. 203-776-WNPR. We're talking about, should we gut the humanities, get rid of the humanities for the job pipeline at colleges and universities? What makes an educated person? We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Find out what we talk about on the show, online, anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, we have up there a huge kit to prepare you for Thanksgiving. Incredibly delicious recipes, our wine recommendations, value wines with great taste and all that. Here's what we're doing right now. Gina Borecka, her Hartford Current column on the war on humanities in universities and colleges has a lot of people talking, debating, You know, should we, by the way, that column's at our website, WNPR.org, if you want to see it now or later. Should we minimize art, music, literature, languages, philosophy, the humanities, and beef up the sciences, math, and technology where the jobs are? So they say the big question, what makes an educated person? Gene, I want to talk with you about what demographers say about this and what CEOs sometimes say about this and what message that might send to colleges and universities or to parents who feel pressured. They want their kids to succeed. Michael, Faith Middleton, welcome to the show. Gina Breck is here. Go ahead.
Hi, Faith and Gina.
Hi.
I'm a parent of a high school senior and a freshman in college, and I do support them taking classes in the humanities. I do think it will give them a well-rounded education. However, if they told me that they were changing their major to history, I would immediately stop paying for their college education. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why, if I may.
Yeah.
I am an assistant principal of a high school, and we had an opening for a social studies teacher in August, and 93 people applied for that one position, including three people that have a law degree. And there is simply no viable economic opportunity for all these people to support themselves and their families. And I think that it would be a mistake, and I've discouraged my children from majoring in the humanities, although I hope they can take a number of classes in it.
Michael, this is just what we've been trying to get at, this intersection of protecting your children, being practical with your children on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, I hear you saying you want them to be well-rounded people. I think you're right at that nexus, and I can't thank you for your comments enough. Gina, what do you say to a conversation like this? Michael's describing all these people who is, thanks, Michael, by the way, who all these people who applied for this one history job. What does that say?
I think that it's very good. And Michael may have been one of the people who responded, actually, to the Hartford Current article in print, because I think it's interesting that himself as an educator is choosing to sort of make sure that his children have a limited number of options when it comes to their choices in education, and that he's making that decision about it financially and saying that he would cut off sort of their financial, access to an education. And while I can understand that, because you want to make a good investment, I'm really sorry that our conversations, and I don't think it's just Michael, I mean, I think it's how we think about it, that we have monetized, to use that word, everything in our culture. So that it's like, it's only going to be what's the payoff. I'm making this much of an investment in your education, which is an argument for, you know, us to keep a cap on how much education costs to make sure that people have access to financial aid. And that includes not only working class families, but middle class families. And to make sure that our students don't come out with $200,000 worth of debt so that they're not sort of, you know, shackled to the amounts of money that they had. But I think that we don't know. You see, this is the whole thing about what's going to happen in the next 20 years. When Michael's kids are out, there could be a glut of engineers because now everybody's making their kid become an engineer mm-hmm. or a pharmacist or a mathematician mm-hmm. or an actuary. And then in 20 years, there are going to be no more lawyers.
And the technology of right. that world has moved on. So Michael, though, is saying that he wants his kids in the humanities and he wants them also to major. It's not that he doesn't want them to have exposure to the humanities, to round them out, but he wants them to major in something practical where there are more jobs. What's wrong with that?
I think that really to choose a major based on what you think, what you're projecting, what you're depending on statistics for people who don't know the future, as opposed to where your child, where the student, where the individual has strengths and interest, has a passion. You know, there are people you cannot force somebody, you cannot contort somebody into a figure that they can't make themselves into. If someone does not have an interest, a passion for, and their imagination is not captured by, you know, becoming an actuary. And I actually talked to the Actuarial Association of America. They were very nice people. But it's a particular kind of thing. You can't make somebody do that.
You're not saying, though, that if a student has a high focus, high interest, high passion for science, for math, for then legitimate.
Of course,
but
that's
why,
of course.
Why wouldn't a college or university also want to expose that child?
Right. And as, I'm not even talking about exposure, but just so that, that somehow that that's dismissed as soft. What the humanities are now, everybody's referring to them, and this is sort of part of what I didn't get to say in the article, but I hope I'll write something longer about it, that those are the soft subjects. That is as if only the sciences and mathematically based subjects or subject areas are hard, that those are, that it's just easy, that only lazy students do English, only lazy students would do history.
Jessica Faith Middleton, welcome to the show with Gina Bereke. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. Big fan of your show.
Thank you.
I just want to say I'm laying the groundwork for my comment by saying that I have a 17-year-old, and I raised him to talk about theology, talk about the social sciences, books, literature, movies, all these sorts of art subjects. He's a musician himself. I'm very supportive of that. I pay for lessons. I really invest a lot of money in that. That being said, I double majored in biology and chemistry. I had a very, very hard time finding work when I got out of school. Now, the issue that I have with it is supply and demand. If somebody wants to go into college and just take their chemistry courses, just take their biology courses and pay for those courses and not have to be required to take all of these humanities subjects, I think that would be an intelligent decision on the university's part. Just because of the investment somebody's making in their education should be up to the person, not up to the university, as to what's being required.
Mm. Well, that's fascinating to get at. Why do universities then, while they're gutting those departments, why are they requiring that you take courses in them?
Yes, you know,
what is that saying?
It all comes down to the student or, you know, the parent or the student, that it comes out of their pocket in the end. And I think a parent or a student should have a say in what's being required of them. I think they should have a say in what they want to invest in.
Jessica, thank you so much for your comment. Really
sure,
appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Jean, you want to have a quick response before we go on to another thing?
Sure. It's actually, again, we're back to the sort of monetary, this is what things cost, we can buy anything. You actually don't buy an education. You earn an education. And the education is given to you. A degree is actually not given to you by the university. The degree is awarded by the faculty of the university. It's not the institution. It's the faculty at the university who give the degree. And that you get a degree not because you have, again, trained in certain areas, but because you have an education. And it's sort of the universal part of a university. It's the part that brings things together so that it's not a fragmented, balkanized sense of pieces of information. It's not just stuff that you can look up online. It's actually an education that weaves together. You know, it's like the fabric of our lives. It's like a cotton commercial, but it weaves together all of these different things so that you have an understanding of how they work together, not just isolated pieces of information, so that you're looking down on a screen and hitting something with your thumb.
And can understand the links
right.
from one life to another, one practice to another, kind of wider field.
And
of
to see the intersections between everything. That's what an education actually is.
Larry, Faith Middleton with Gina Bereke. Welcome to the show. Go ahead, Larry.
I have two sons that are well-employed and they're out of college. And I have two children that are still in college. I disagree. You certainly do buy an education because that's what you're paying for. And the kids have to earn it. And I understand that as well. But in the humanities, I think you have to break it down. There are certain humanities, no matter what you take. I worked for a Swedish and German companies before, and they are constantly looking for students that have a language background. You know, you know, maybe whether or not you have a, so that you could have a liberal arts degree, but be fluent in, let's say, German or French. And be able to translate and be able to help out in any type of instance. So there are certain humanities that do help. But I'm a well-educated person with a master's, an MBA, childhood education, and a general degree in science. And my science degree has kept me employed. You know, now, and I also understand what you said before. there could be a glut of engineers, but it's easier for engineers to learn science than if you have a glut of history teachers trying to learn engineering.
Oh, that's an interesting point, Larry. Thank you so much for your comment. Gina, what about that? Thank you very much for listening. Go ahead.
Okay. To take the first point, actually, I think it's fascinating about languages. Americans are still the only – one of the things that embarrasses me when I lecture – I've been lucky enough to lecture around the world. I just came back from being on a doctoral exam in the University of London. I'm the only professor – and many who are like me, sadly, in America, who basically speaks one language. I mean, I can get by in French because my mother was French-Canadian, and I had to pass my exams. But, I mean, everybody speaks other languages. And we have fallen short of that in our country. We make our students take language exams. They can pass out of it. They can take these tests that are supposed to be proficiency exams. But we don't really have... We don't traffic in other languages the way we should. But what I would argue is that what we need to do is not only have students who can understand other languages, but have to understand the culture. If you're going to go work in Germany, you better have a better sense of history than a lot of students do who don't know the difference between World War I, World War II, the Weimar Republic, who don't know who Brecht is, who Weil is, and what the implications of what Hannah Arendt said. That's actually going to matter if you are going to do more than be a technician at a German company. If you are going to be somebody who is going to lead, if we want to produce, as I think that we all want to do, if we want our children to be leaders and inventors and people who are going to be happy, can we factor in the happy part? I mean, to amuse oneself, I mean, you have to be somebody who enjoys what you do. To enjoy is to be able to make those connections. And I'm sorry, I think it was Larry, right? I would disagree with Larry. No, you don't pay. I mean, this is not, it's not like in The Wizard of Oz, where at the end, where they say to, is the, which one is it? It's the straw man. And he says, you know, the Wizard of Oz says, I can't give you a brain, but I can give you a diploma. That is not what great universities do. Maybe it's what you can pay for. Maybe it's what you think people are paying for. That is not what a university does. You are not paying for the diploma. You are paying for the education that your students get.
Well, this mention of history and this example of what does the student know getting this job and ending up in a German company, what does he or she know? Jeff, you're a history teacher, I gather?
Hi, hello?
Hi, Jeff, you're a history teacher, right?
No, I told your screener that I have a history degree.
History degree.
But I work in pharmaceutical regulatory operations.
So what do you say about what Gina was just mentioning, where there is, I mean, has your history degree been useful to you in your work in some way?
Well, as part of my history education at the University of Connecticut, by the way.
Oh, good.
I learned how to be to have an evaluative process of thinking. How to be reflective, how to do meaningful research, how to be an effective writer of not only technical language, but just being able to write SOPs and process improvement, all kinds of areas. Not related to hard science, that I think you need a balance. You need a balance to be able to work with people, to communicate with them. It's not all black and white in what we do, even in a science related field.
You know,
there's a lot of people actually within my group that are have humanities degrees. So there is hope out there for people who, you know, have an interest in science, an interest in more than one thing. I've always had an interest in science, but I also had a love for history, and it wasn't necessarily my first choice when I went to UConn, but I gravitated towards it because it's what I had a passion for. And I don't think what we want is to have generations of children graduating from college doing things that they don't want to do. You know, you want them to be, I have two myself, and I want them to be successful. But I think that, you know, as long as you work hard, you're a good learner, you're an effective communicator, you know how to write well, you can find your way into all different types of careers that you didn't necessarily think that you would be in when you graduated.
Oh, thank you for your comments, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Really, really appreciate it.
Can I say, I mean, Jeff, you should come and talk at UConn. That was a great comment. I mean, that's really, but it's true, because I also believe, I mean, what Jeff is saying is that, and I'm hearing this from one of my students who I still keep in touch with, graduated 10 years ago and went on to get her master's in English at Trinity, is now working for a fuel cell company. And just got promoted to a vice presidency, which she works in marketing. But she's their scribe. She's the one who translates. I mean, it's not translating from German, but it's translating from science. And one of the people who actually commented on, I don't know if it was the Current site or one of the other papers, said that she works for the National Science Foundation, the NSF. And right, National Science Foundation. And I can write, but I can't do letters. And she said that she takes points off, that she has dismissed grant proposals because they were inarticulate, poorly focused, and the person could not put into language what was clearly a good concept.
Gina, there was a piece on 60 Minutes recently. It was an update. So I know it had been on before. And it showed that people in Paraguay, a very poor country, they have these gigantic dumps filled with garbage that go on for hundreds of football fields. And there are so many human beings with rakes whose job it is every day to break open the bags. These are citizens that just do this and then grab whatever they can to sell. So somebody, a music person, has the idea, would it be possible for you to find things? If I can find a guy who could fashion instruments from the things you find. So they make guitars from the trays of toaster ovens, flutes with, you know, pop tops from soda cans for the keys, and these instruments, and they sound really cool. And now we've got this teacher who's teaching these kids. I'm watching these kids. Now these kids are performing all over the world with their, and real instruments are coming to them, and they're hearing what a cello really sounds like. I'm watching these kids, and I'm thinking, probably the majority of these kids are not going to end up in music. But what is this experience teaching them about focus and discipline and passion and teamwork? That's what this is doing, you know, and just some larger appreciation of the world. And who knows where they end up. But I think because of their exposure to this, they feel they have possibility.
And that's learning anything. I was wondering where you were heading with the large dump in Paraguay and how we were taking that back to the humanities. So I'm very relieved. But I think that that's certainly just watching students open up, and that happens everywhere. I mean, it's why, and at any age. I mean, that's why even continuing education programs. I mean, for people, I was thinking back to the earlier caller who just wanted to take the courses that she wanted to take, and that's what continuing education lets you do. You could just go and learn what you need to learn, but it's not the process of, again,
it's what TiVo lets you do.
It's what TiVo, and it's what MOOCs are going to let you do with those massive online courses that are being delivered will let you do. But it's not going to give you the kind of coherent education.
And you know what's interesting? When I've seen a few documentaries on these companies out in Silicon Valley, you know, just so ahead of the curve, these companies doing ingenious things. And what are they? What does it look like inside the company? The CEO gets this idea of bringing in 20 people from 20 different disciplines,
right,
musicians and doctors and librarians, and says, here's a problem we've got to solve. I'm throwing it out there.
Right.
What do you all think? Because he knows that the answer is going to come from many, many perspectives.
Right.
I think that's what we're talking about. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'd like to hear from you about what makes an educated person. What's going on with gutting the humanities in colleges and universities? Is that a good idea? What about the job pipeline for your kids who don't have jobs? Very complex, very interesting, and very important. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Faith Middleton. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, F-A-I-T-H-W-N-P-R. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening. And to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack, producer Jonathan McNichol, and our special guest, returning guest for so many years, Gina Barreca. And we're going to continue our conversation. I want to let you know about this because we had this film, a discussion about this film on the show. There is now going to be a New York premiere of Treasures from the Rubble in Sag Harbor, New York, East End of Long Island, Saturday, December 7th, 5 p.m. at Bay State Theater. It's part of the Hamptons Take Two Documentary Festival. You can contact Bay Street Theater. I'm going to moderate a very freewheeling panel just before the film with lots of people. That's going to be at the American Hotel in Sag Harbor on December 7th, around 3 in the afternoon. And that panel will include Academy Award winner, actress Mercedes Rule. She is from, of course, theater, television, and film. She has taught at Juilliard, and she's going to talk about the unstoppable creative impulse from an acting point of view. And then lots and lots of other people from other worlds. Of course, filmmaker Alexandra Branion, who talks about her film Treasures from the Rubble and that unstoppable creative impulse that came from these outsider artists that she featured in the film. Edward Butcher, the poet, critic, and author of Conrad Aiken, is and Sylvia Plath is going to be talking from his point of view. Juliana Driver, curator, writer, and researcher at the American Folk Art Museum, is going to be doing something. Margaret Kitchings, who's a composer and vocalist, is going to be talking. Aaron Lewis, who is director of audiovisual at the Museum of Modern Art, adjunct professor at Columbia, will talk about the unstoppable creative impulse that spans multiple arts, including video design and installation. So you see, it's going to go on and on. There are about 10 people on this panel. It's going to be a wild freewheeling, and I can't wait to hear it. Contact Bay State Theater if you'd like more information on the panel I'm going to moderate or on the showing of the film itself. And we'll be sure and tell you about this one more time just before the event happens. Gina Barreca is here, and she has written a great column at our website right now. It appeared in The Current. Lots and lots of conversation and response. And it's about the war on humanities in universities and colleges. It's got a lot of people talking and debating. You know, should we minimize art, music, literature, history, languages, and philosophy, the humanities, and beef up the sciences that are bringing in all the money, math, technology, supply chain, all those things that draw money to universities from these corporations? Parents are nervous. Kids are nervous about getting jobs. And so it raises, everything raises this question, what makes an educated person? So, Gina, we're going to go to the phones in a second, but I think about demographers whose job it is to hold a mirror up to communities, cities in particular. And they're skilled in looking at age and ethnicity and how many children born, how many people dying, at what rate, how many citizens move in, move out. And then they hold up a mirror and they say, this is what's going to happen to you. Well, demographers and CEOs of companies and small businesses go to colleges and universities and they say, here's what's needed. You know, we need the young people to stay. The corporations say, we need people trained in this. They go to community colleges and say, give us these skilled kids. I would love to know what these CEOs, small business leaders would say. Do you want someone who just knows X, your thing? Which is fine, but what if I can give you X plus?
Okay, what I want to know, because they're going to say, oh, no, of course we want that for everybody. What I want to know is where these men and women, I want to know the CEOs and the directors of companies and the successful men and women who are going in to talk to universities. Mm-hmm. I want to know what their backgrounds are. My bet is that they came from places where they did not have somebody say, you have to learn this narrow band of skills because you are learning out of fear. We cannot educate people out of fear.
But what are universities supposed to do when the money that's coming in the door is for sciences and math and foundation grants and all?
Then we use it to uphold the mission of the university itself, not to pay back just those people. That's like living in a family where if it's a good family and you have a rich uncle who only likes four of the kids, if it's a good family, those four kids make sure everybody gets some of what that rich uncle gives them.
So if money comes in from, say, sports, that money is distributed across the university, including sports.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if the money comes in for, you know, just the sciences, technology, engineering, and mathematics, then that doesn't mean, oh, we have to cut other departments who aren't those departments so that we can make sure that all the money stays in those places. That means, isn't it great that we've got money coming in there? Let's make sure that everything is strong so that we don't have an uneven distribution of resources.
Do you think boards of trustees give presidents the freedom to think like that? Presidents of universities and colleges are fundraisers.
I love Susan Herbst. I think she's doing a great job
at UConn, at University,
at the
of,
University
Connecticut.
Of Connecticut. And I think it's the hardest job in the world, all of these college presidents. I know a number of them, you know, from many, many different schools at this point. I just was giving a talk out in Shippensburg, met the president there. I understand that they need to get the donations where they can get the donations. But I also think it's very important to make sure that the message is sent to the deans, to all levels of administration, that the support is essential for those departments that are not considered money makers, even if they make money, that they are not considered money makers, that we, you know, that departments of English, of foreign languages, of philosophy, of art, of dance, of theater, that those, even if they are not yet, because who knows where the big donors are going to come from. I mean, NEAG, the money that started the School of Education, those were donors that came in from there. You don't know where the donors are going to come from, but you can't just play for the money. You have to play for the students.
We see this in a lot of worlds right now. Look at publishing.
Right.
Money is going to the blockbuster folks, and that old idea that...
But that's a for-profit company. These are not-for-profit institutions. Universities and colleges are not-for-profit institutions. They need to give a foundation for their endowments and all the rest of it. They need not to go bankrupt. But this is a not-for-profit institution. It's different from a publisher. As much as we like to think that publishers are not-for-profit institutions, they aren't. Can I just interject? I'm going to read one paragraph here that I really do think sort of emphasizes the point that we were just discussing, that what education does is it allows for authentic advancement and achievement. That's what it prepares students for coming away with, authentic advancement and achievement. And what that means is understanding what it is to be a true citizen and not a repeater of unexamined platitudes. It means becoming a compassionate and self-reliant human being, a good parent, a caring member of a community, and somebody who can be trusted to teach the next generation, the one after them, something other than greed, territoriality, anger, outrage, bitterness, and a blinkered vision of the unmapped parts of the world and the mind. That's what a good education gives you.
Lynn Faith Middleton with Gina Barreca. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Faith.
Lynn, I just wanted to say you can hear and rather see the rest of Gina's essay at our website, WNPR.org. Just click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Sorry, Lynn. Go ahead.
No problem. I am a 23-year-old first-year student, well, not student teacher anymore, teacher, and I'm a history teacher. And I remember when I first came out with my undergrad, my history degree, and then going into my master's for education, thinking to myself, as all of your teachers say, you know, teaching isn't for everyone, thinking, oh, Lord, what if I don't like teaching? What am I supposed to do with this history degree now? I don't know if I can go into something else. It's kind of like a dead-end stop for me, especially since I had such a drive to get to education. But then once I started teaching and going into the history department that I'm in now, our history department is actually understaffed to the point where we have the most electives that students want to take in the history department. Because not because they want to go into history or they wanted to go into humanities, but it's a break from the hard AP sciences, the math. It's an enjoyable experience for them to take a second and to see the world in a different view. And to survey them at the end of the year of why did you take this elective as opposed to something that is going to better your business career that you want to go to college. Hmm. It's just enjoy it.
Yeah.
They have a love for it, and it helps them view the world and take a breather and almost just even relax in their own atmosphere of business, science, math.
You know, Lynn, I many times on this show wish that I could go back and take art history and history. And then I realized what I really should take is American Studies, because it covers all of the humanities. And it would be, you know, it's just so amazing. I thought, I wish they'd had that when I was going to school. So thank you so much for your comments.
Thank you.
Okay. Gina, this idea of what we treasure from ancient cultures is interesting. We don't go into museums and see beakers. And, we do see suits of armor, you know, we see mummies, but we see artifacts of a culture that I think reflect the humanities. It ends up being what is important from who these people were.
Well, I mean, that's the human part of humanities.
I'm not discounting Copernicus and Galileo and, you know, trust me, I'm not.
Right. No. And again, as somebody wrote into me, I mean, you know, it was Pope who wrote, you know, God said, let Newton be, and then there was light. I mean, of course the sciences enlighten us. That of course, I mean, this all goes together. It's not that in any way I am undermining or trying to undercut the importance of the sciences and math and other ways of understanding. Those are crucial. Those are what make my car run so I can drive here to New Haven to do the show. It's what allows the airwaves, you know, it allows us to keep the lights on. But that what makes the fun part of life, what gives us the dance in life, is to be able to have the conversation, to come in and share these ideas, to be able to explain them.
You're talking about the range it takes to make an educated person.
Right. And that it's also, but that to understand why things work, not just how they work, not just to read the manual. Not just to look down at the floor and see the dance steps and go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, because I understand how this works, but to feel the music, to own the music. When you really, the thing about education is that nobody can take it away from you. You learn things. It really isn't just a degree. It's really not just getting a set of skills. It's being able to put them all together in a way that makes your heart work. And it's great that you know how to heart work. So if you're going to go to be a surgeon, that's terrific. I don't want you just to know the words to Cole Porter, but it's great if you could sing.
This is exactly, I think about Einstein and the many things he said about humanity that had nothing to do with practical science. Mm-hmm. And so we saw someone with a wide field of vision and probably informing his work and his ideas. 203-776-9677. We have about a minute to go. So let's wrap up. But one thing we said was we have nothing against the sciences, math, and, you know, all that good stuff. And we all took those courses. Grateful for them, learned lots of things. The question is whether universities and colleges are making a mistake by taking resources from the humanities and throwing it all into science because more money is coming in there, or there's a sense that's going to be the new world.
Right.
To what degree do universities have to hang on to this, answering this question, what makes an educated person? Thank you, Gina Baraka, as always. Brilliant. You can see her full essay at our website, WNPR.org. And click on programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Also see our Thanksgiving recipe kit there. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.